Well, I'll introduce Luz Cayuela. Luis is associate professor at the Universidad Rey Juan Carlos of Madrid. Luis studied environmental sciences in Madrid and then did a master's in UCL and a PhD also in forest ecology, I think, in Madrid. And he teaches conservation ecology, biology, ecology, and statistics. And his research interests are in tropical forests, especially in the Andean range, with an integrative perspective, including the functioning, structure, dynamics, and management of tropical ecosystems. Belongs to a tropical ecology lab, which is an interinstitutional group of professors and researchers that share multidisciplinary interests in the field of tropical biology, including topics as community ecology, floristics, and botany. And he collaborates and has with several research institutions from all around the world, especially in Colombia, Ecuador, Peru, Argentina, and others worldwide. So I leave it to you, Luis.
Okay, thanks a lot, Emma, for your presentation, and thanks for being here, particularly to the young generations. I'm really happy to be here. This is my second time in Oxford, actually. First time was long time ago, in 2005, summer 2005, while I was doing a research placement here at the end of my PhD. And ever since then, I've been trying just to come back to Oxford to search for an opportunity to come back here. So here I am. And I'm really thankful to the OCETF to give me the opportunity to be here today. The title of my presentation is Inside a Tropical Mountain Forest. I know it's rather vague, my fault, but it was intentional just to try to cover a broad range of topics which I'm going to talk about today, including plant biodiversity, functional ecology, ecosystem functioning, biography, and evolution, just to say a few of them. And you can see in the title that this talk is about tropical mountain forest, so probably the first question is to define what is a tropical mountain forest. So how many of you have ever been in a tropical mountain forest? Can you raise your hands? So all of you are missing tropical mountain forest, but you'll be there then. Okay, so I bet that if I would ask you to define or to describe your experience while being in a tropical mountain forest, we'll come up with many different definitions of what a tropical mountain forest is, emphasizing different elements of characteristics of this kind of ecosystem. And that makes sense considering that tropical mountain forests encompass a broad range of elevations. They span along broad elevational gradients from 500 meters above sea level up to 4,000 meters in the highest elevations, for example, in the Andes. And along this elevational gradient, we have change in abiotic conditions, particularly temperature, which is going to result in change in the vegetation we see, particularly in the structure of the vegetation. So you've been in tropical mountain forests at different elevations, you are going to have different experiences of what a tropical mountain forest is. So if we have to come up with a single definition of what a tropical mountain forest is, probably one of the most accepted definitions of tropical mountain forest is that of a forest that is frequently covered with cloud or moist. So that is probably the what makes all tropical mountain forests around the world unique. They have frequent and persistent cloud all throughout the year. Tropical mountain forests can be found all around the world, particularly. Do we have a pointer here? You know, like this.
I should do this one.
They can be found all around the world, particularly in the Neotropics, but also in Southeastern Asia. In tropical Africa, they cover a lower extent than in the other two continents. In tropical Australia, they are practically absent, and they can be also found in some tropical islands. Though in those islands, they are usually found at lower elevational ranges than in the mainland. In the Neotropics, tropical mountain forests can be found mostly in the Andes. The Andes have a complex biographical history which has contributed enormously to the evolution of the biota we can see today. If we take the vascular plant genera of Andean tropical mountain forests, we will realize that many of the taxa we have come from different origins. So we have some taxa that came from North America across the Panama Isthmus some 5 to 2 million years ago, and some of these taxa are tropical, subtropical or temperate species that were migrating southwards during the Miocene cooling looking for warmer places. So when the Panama Isthmus was appeared, they just got across the Panama Isthmus and found in the Andes a suitable place to survive while getting stuck in the whole Arctic. But there are also some other taxa that can be found nowadays in the whole Arctic. For example, a species from the genus Quercus or Alnus that are there between South America and North America. We can also found some other taxa that migrated northwards from southern South America and that had in the past a broader Austral-Antarctic distribution, and many other taxa that have evolved in the neotropical region. And many of these taxa have ancestors in species that used to live in the lowland, tropical or green forest in the Amazonia. And with the rise of the Andes, the final rise of the Andes, some 20 to 5 million years ago, they migrated upwards, split their populations, and through fragmentation of their populations as vicarians, we got new species evolving from these ancestors. So we have many things going on. We have these elevational gradients where abiotic conditions change a lot, and this is going to have an impact in the resulting vegetation. We have these latitudinal gradients where we can see the footprint of past events. So this makes the Andes a truly natural lab just to explore ecological questions. And this is the lab where we have been working for the last 5 years. We are lucky to have this opportunity. And our team, our group, has been doing research, conducting research in many different topics concerning tropical ecology, ecology of tropical forests, particularly community assembly, things related to community assembly, functional ecology, and ecosystem function. So remains of this talk, I'm going to tell you about some of the results we've got concerning these major topics. So for community assembly, one of the recurring questions in tropical ecology that has fascinated scientists for the last 2 centuries, beginning with the early explorers of the 18th century, how can so many species coexist in the Andes? How can we have so many species in tropical ecosystems? You just make a rough comparison of species diversity in tropical versus temperate or cold regions, you can see easily the difference. For example, you can get 23 species per hectare on average in a temperate forest, 30 species maybe in the most diverse forest in the Appalachian Mountains in North America. But in any tropical forest you get around the world, you can easily find something like 40 to 100 tree species per hectare, and reaching numbers as high as 300 tree species in the most diverse forest. So that's amazing. And this pattern is not exclusive of trees. You can get the same pattern for any other, almost any other group of organisms you choose. So to explain high species coexistence in tropical ecosystems, many mechanisms have been proposed, being environmental filtering and competitive exclusion among the most embraced ones. According to environmental filtering, the abiotic environment acts as a sieve, allowing those species that have particular traits or phenotypes to succeed in establishing and surviving while the rest fail. And on the other hand, competitive exclusion posits that species compete for resources until one excludes the other, and therefore the more different two species are, the more likely they are to coexist, to be together in the same place. To address the community assembly issue, functional ecology has emerged as a more powerful tool than classical taxonomical approaches, since indices of community composition and abundance provide little to no information about the ecological strategies of the species. Instead, functional ecology relies on the measurement of functional traits that can be some of them easily measure, for example, leaf area or wood density, and these traits provide some information, relevant information about the ecological strategies of a species, and therefore they are truly capable to reveal the outcome of a species interaction with their abiotic and biotic environment. For the last 10 to 20 years, different researchers have tried to disentangle the relative role of environmental filtering and competitive exclusion using this functional approach. And typically, what people have done today is just to put these two mechanisms together and to see which one is, so to say, contributing the most to explaining patterns of community assemblage. And this has been done by looking at the response of traits. So we, in a certain community, we get that traits are more similar than expected by chance. That might be understood as a signal, as an outcome of environmental filtering. Whereas if traits, functional traits, are more different than expected by chance, then that might be understood as an outcome of a process of competitive expansion. But the point here is that these two processes might be operating at the same time. So it's not a matter, at least in my opinion, it's not a matter of which one is truly determining the species assemblies, but which is the relative contribution of each one of these two processes to explain patterns of the species assembly. So to address this question, we made this experimental design and we studied two environmental gradients, two altitudinal gradients, one in southern Ecuador in Podocarpus National Park and the other one in central Peru in Rio Viso National Park, both in the western side of the Andes facing the Amazonia, and spanning along 2,000 meters range from 1,000 to 3,000 meters above sea level. And in those two sites, we sample vegetation in 30.1 hectare plots subdivided in a smaller 10 by 10. These smaller quadrants are 10 by 10 subplots. And in each plot, we recorded all trees with a diameter of breast height above 2.5 centimeters, and we measure different functional traits, for example, specific leaf area, leaf thickness, and wood density, just to cite a few. And then we try to identify these two mechanisms by using different subsets of our data. So to identify the signal of competitive exclusion, we compare trait distance between species co-occurring within the same subplot with trait distance between species that were within the same plot but in different subplots. And therefore, if we are able to detect trait over dispersion at this scale, very local scale, that might be understood as an outcome of competitive exclusion. In addition, by comparing trait distance between species that are within the same plot but not as close together as to be competing for the same resources, so we exclude the possibility for a species to get paired with another species within the same subplot. You see that? With trait distance with the species that were in different plots along the elevational gradient, we intend to detect the signal of this process of environmental filtering. So our point was that these two processes might be explaining species assemblages at different spatial scales, and that hasn't been done today, because most of the people put both processes together and try to see which one is overwhelming the other. They are confronting both mechanisms, and both mechanisms might coexist actually to explain these patterns of species assembly. So, what did we get? Unfortunately, we did not get this signal of competitive exclusion for any of the two sites and any of the functional traits we measure. And we got this strong signal of environmental filtering going on at large spatial scale. So it seems, according to our results, that environmental filtering is the overriding mechanism determining the species composition in our community. So we try to go a step further and correlate these patterns of trait clustering within each community with distances, with abiotic conditions. So what we did was to pair to get pairs of plots at different positions in the elevational gradient, and then we try to see if there was a correlation. Oops, sorry. Got the wrong. Here we go, sorry. Okay, so we try to get a relationship between this pattern of trade clustering with environmental distance. So we got pairs of plots, and then we calculate this index, which is brought from the field of population genetics, which measures trade over, which can be understood in terms of getting trade over dispersion trade clustering. So positive value of this index is pointing up to a pattern of clustering, trade clustering. So by comparing pairs of plots that were at different abiotic distances, so for that we took mean annual temperature. So for example, plotting the upper tropical mountain forest is under cold conditions, and separated 12 degrees centigrade from a plot that is in the lower tropical mountain forest. And our point here is that if differences in trade clustering are determined by differences in abiotic conditions, this pattern of trade clustering might be understood like being truly the outcome of a process of environmental filtering. And this seems so, as you can see here, that there is always a positive relationship between these two indices for the two sides and most of the functional traits we measure. And we also wanted to show that greater community functional differences were mostly the result of strong climatic affinities. So to achieve that, what we did was to identify those species that were the most abundant in the upper and the lower tropical mountain forests, and then we retrieved data, presence data for those species from the Global Biodiversity Information Facility, the GBIF, and then we tried to define the thermal niches of these species under the assumption that if those species that were thriving in the highlands and in the lowlands had different climatic niches, then we could understand that their functional differences might be the outcome of this process of environmental filtering maintained across the neotropics, because these are the true thermal niches of the species, not the thermal niches within our study area. And effectively, we got that what we expected. So you can see that species in the upper belt of our gradients usually have thermal niches that are quite segregated from the thermal niches of the species that are in the upper, in the lower part of the gradient, which are live under warmer conditions. And as I said, this response is maintained across the entire neotropics. Okay, more about community assembly. Another way to get high gamma species diversity is by getting a high replacement of a species along gradients. And that seems to occur in the case of elevational gradients. So we try to explore this issue of a species turnover by comparing how a species, or by investigating how a species changes along the elevational gradients. And we try also to test one hypothesis proposed by Daniel Janssen in 1976, which he published in a seminal paper entitled "Why Mountain Passes Are Higher in the Tropics than in Temperate Regions." And in this paper, Daniel Janssen proposed that because of the existence of seasonality in temperate regions, a species has to experience different environmental conditions throughout the year, and therefore they have broader thermal niches, broader climatic niches, and because they have broader climatic niches, when you take a species at low and high elevations within an elevational gradient, their thermal niches, or their climatic niches in a broader sense, are going to overlap quite a lot. And that is going to have a result. That is not said by Daniel Janssen, but that's necessarily the result of that hypothesis, and is that the species turnover is going to be low. Because if the species can be found at broad elevational gradients, then we are going to have an overlap and low species turnover. Do you follow me? Kind of? Yeah. So, on the contrary, in tropical regions where we don't have seasonality, or seasonality is very low, I'll talk about that later on, species do experience similar conditions all throughout the year, and therefore their climatic niches are going to be narrower than those species that are in temperate regions. Is that okay? Yeah? And therefore, when we compare species at low and high elevations, their niches are gonna are not gonna overlap that much. So this is gonna have, as a result, high species turnover along elevational gradient. As you just move along the elevational gradient, species are gonna change a lot. So that's nothing new. We know that that happens in tropical mountain forests. Okay. But my point here is, okay, that's true and that has been demonstrated when comparing temperate against tropical regions, but there are some changes in seasonality within the tropical region. If you just move away from the Ecuadorian line towards the subtropics, you are gonna see that there is some increase in seasonality. So that's a pattern. So how that increase in seasonality has an effect in species turnover? And that's a hypothesis we're gonna test here. That's basically Janssen's hypothesis, but brought into the region, into the tropical region. Okay, so our point, the point we're gonna demonstrate here, is that the species turnover is gonna decrease when moving from the equator towards the subtropics. So if you just get an elevational gradient in Peru, you should get less turnover, and if you just get another gradient in northern Argentina in Yungas Forest, which is already subtropical, then you should get even lower species turnover. So to test that hypothesis, we got in touch with different collaborators, different researchers around the world, working in the Andes, and we assembled this database consisting of 9 elevational gradients, spanning from central Colombia and Rio Magdalena, down to Yungas Forest in northern Argentina. And we compiled this floristic data, estimated species turnover, and tried to relate species turnover with patterns of latitude and temperature system. So, as I said, we estimated species turnover at different taxonomic resolutions, species, genus, and family level. And we feed these models to relate the species turnover at each taxonomic resolution with elevation distance. What you see in the x-axis here in this figure is not elevation per se, it's elevation distance. So a value of 500 or a value of 1,000 means that between that each point, for example, a point here, is 1,000 meters away. You are comparing two plots that are 1,000 meters away in the elevational gradient. Is that clear? So as you can see, there is very high species turnover, and we have the latitudinal gradient going this way from top to down and from left to side. So it will go that way. And then we got the coefficients of the models we used, which were fitted with a negative exponential model. And we were particularly interested in testing whether these coefficients, in particular the slope of the regression curves, were related with either latitude or temperature seasonality, which should be correlated. And for our frustration, we did not get any result. So as you can see here, there is no relationship at all between the slope of this regression curve and neither latitude nor temperature seasonality. So there is no support to Janssen's hypothesis when bringing this hypothesis into the tropical region. But anyway, what is really amazing is that species turnover, it doesn't matter where you are across the Andes, is surprisingly high. You just move a few hundred meters up or down elevational gradient, and you get about 80 or 90% of the species replaced in the community. And that's very surprising. You have those papers by Richard Condit and Hannah Tomisto discussing whether beta diversity is higher in Panama or in Peruvian Amazonia, but where you can get like very, 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 very high species turnover and beta diversity is in this kind of ecosystem. So, for example, just to give you an example, we have one of the sites where we are working is in southern Ecuador, and within one single watershed where we have sampled 30.1 hectare plot. So that's it, about 3 hectares of forest, spanning from 1,000 to 3,000 meters. We've got more than 800 different tree species, and that's because of a species turnover and beta diversity, high replacement of species. Okay. So moving on to another major topic, functional ecology. We are particularly, one of the studies we are conducting right now is about compound leaves. Hmm? So I told you in the beginning that there are many characteristics of tropical mountain forests that change with elevation. I didn't get too much into detail into that, but one of those characteristics that is reported in classical textbooks is patterns of species compoundness. Hmm? So it has been typically reported that in lowland tropical mountain forests, in lower tropical mountain forests, you get more proportion of species with compound leaves than in upper tropical mountain forests. Okay, and this was proposed for the first time 1 century ago in 1919. Yeah, that's right, by Brown. He conducted a study in Dictorcat forests of Philippines, where he just observed that the proportion of species with compound leaves was lower in lower elevations than in higher, was lower in higher elevations than in lower elevations. And ever since then, there were a couple of studies that reported the same patterns. For example, it comes to my mind this study by Philip Krug and colleagues published in 1963, where they reported the same pattern in an elevational grade in Ecuador. And that's it. And ever since then, like, this has been given like a universal truth for tropical mountain forests. There is a decrease of species, of the proportion of species with compound leaves as you move upwards the gradient. Hmm? But nobody else has tested this in a sound manner. So with that data set I showed you before, with 9 gradients spanning from central Colombia to northern Argentina, we went first to quantify these patterns of decrease in the proportion of species with compound leaves along the elevational gradient. And then we try to explain these patterns by testing different ecological and evolutionary hypotheses. Okay, what is causing these patterns? If that is true, what is causing these patterns? So as for our first goal, you can see that effectively the proportion of the species with compound leaves decrease with elevation. This is this red line. Mm? So in the lowland forest, in the Amazonia, you get about 30% of the species with compound leaves. 30% of the species within your community have compound leaves. Whereas if you just go up to 4,000 meters, in average, no more than 10% of the species in your communities have compound leaves. So this seems to be a generality, at least for Andean tropical mountain forests. We get exactly the same pattern in all our gradients. When going to number of individuals, the proportion of individuals with compound leaves, we get slightly the same pattern, but the slope of this regression curve is not as marked as this one. And then we ask ourselves if there might be some kind of bias, because there are some families such as Fabaceae which are particularly dominant in lowland tropical, in lowland forests. And all the species within that family have compound leaves. So we just remove the effect of this family, Fabaceae, and then the pattern remains, even though the slope of this regression curve is not that marked, at least for proportion of a species with compound leaves, but it didn't maintain anymore for a proportion of individuals with compound leaves. Okay? So from here onwards, we just stick to this variable, proportion of a species with compound leaves, to try to explain this pattern using different hypotheses. And which hypotheses we wanted to test? Different hypotheses. Some of them are ecological hypotheses, some of them are more evolutionary, and some of them have been previously tested in the context of a study led by Ana Malado in the Amazonia, such as the seasonal growth hypothesis and the rapid growth hypothesis. But some others are new. Mm? We are going to test them for the first time in this kind of context, such as, for example, the mechanical resistance hypothesis or the higher leafing intensity hypothesis. I'm going to explain them briefly right now. Okay. So, as for the seasonal drought hypothesis, this hypothesis proposed that compound leaves have lower transpiratory water loss, and therefore we would expect a higher proportion of species with compound leaves associated to drier conditions. Okay, does it make sense? If they have lower transpiratory water loss, they are gonna appear more frequently in those environments that are dry. But we got just the opposite result. We just got higher proportion of species with tampon leaves, for example here, associated to those conditions were that were wetter, not dry. For example, where precipitation of the driest month is the highest, or where precipitation of the driest quarter is the highest, or where precipitation seasonality is the lowest. So obviously it's not that we didn't find support for this hypothesis, but we just find evidence against this hypothesis. Anna Malad in the Amazonia found also no support for this hypothesis with her data, with the data of the rainfall network of plots. So this hypothesis doesn't seem to be explaining the observed patterns of changes in leaf compactness. Okay, let's move to the next hypothesis, the mechanical resistance hypothesis. Pretty fond of this hypothesis. I like it very much. This hypothesis says that compound leaves are an ecological advantage for those species that are exposed to windy conditions. So the probability of their branches to break decrease because they have more mechanical resistance to wind. So if that is true, where would we expect compound leaves to appear? Which kind of trees? What do you think? Highest trees, the trees that are about the canopy level, right? The emerging trees. So if that is right, we would expect that those species that grow the most, that are emerging trees, will have more probabilities to have compound leaves. Is that right? Okay, so to test this hypothesis, we just took the entire list of species we had in this data set, which was more than 4,000 species, something like that, and then we tried to get a measure of maximum tree size of that species using all the data available within the data set. So ideally, we should have used height, but we didn't get that variable measured consistently across the entire data set. So we use instead maximum diameter and breast height, which is a surrogate of tree size as well, and typically it's quite correlated with height. Okay, so we found some kind of relationship. You can see that the probability of a species to have compound leaf is kind of related with maximum tree size. So the maximum the tree size, the more the probability of having compound leaf. But then we realized that again there was this phylogenetical signal. Some genus and some particular family have all their species with compound leaves or with simple leaves. Okay, so we include these as random factors in our models, and when doing so, these random phylogenetic effects accounting for almost all the observed variability. More than 99% of the probability of a species to have compound leaf was explained by this phylogenetic sign. While the maximum tree size didn't explain almost nothing of the remaining variability. So again, no support for this hypothesis to explain the observed pattern. Okay, I'm moving to the third ecological hypothesis, which is the rapid growth hypothesis. And this hypothesis says that compound leaf is a cheap leaf, and therefore is associated to a set of traits that are usually displayed by pioneer species. So species that don't invest too much in resources, but they just want to grow rapidly. So if that is true, compound leaves should be associated to other traits of pioneer species, such as low wood density. Okay. So we try to find a correlation or relationship between the probability of a species to have compound leaf with wood density, using part of our data set, because we didn't have wood density measured consistently for all the species in the 9 gradients. And again, when accounting for phylogenetical random effects, these phylogenetical random effects accounting for much of the explained variability in the response variable, and wood density didn't explain anything at all. So it proved to be not relevant to explain the probability of a species to have compound leaf. Anna Malado in the Amazonia found some slight support to this hypothesis. No, it was not like strong support, but some support. But we did not find any support with our data set. So here we are. We have a pattern, but we have no mechanism. We found no evidence for any of these ecological hypotheses to explain patterns of decrease in the proportion of species with compound leaves. But what we have noticed right now is that there is a strong phylogenetic sign. Okay, so the question that remains now is, can this phylogenetic sign be the outcome of some evolutionary mechanism? That might be. That is what we are going to test in our next hypothesis, which is the higher leafing intensity hypothesis. And according to, this hypothesis was proposed by Looney Arsen in a paper published quite recently in 2012 in the New Ideas in Ecology and Evolution journal. And what Looney proposed is that compound leaves do not provide any ecological advantages to a species, but they are a trade-off or an evolutionary advantage. And that is because producing more leaves generates a larger fat bank and therefore more opportunities for generating novel adaptive mutations. So it's a way to mutate more rapidly and therefore generate genetic diversity for a species and therefore more possibilities to evolve. Okay, so that's a trade-off. You can see compound leaves in a tree, and that is not involving an ecological adaptation to anything, but it's just a trade-off of an evolutionary adaptation. And according to Looney, this kind of trait is relatively young in the tree of life. So we expect those species that have compound leaves to be younger from a phylogenetic perspective. So we are now testing this hypothesis. Unfortunately, that is not our results. That's what we expect. Okay, we are building the phylogenetic tree. And we want to test whether the probability of a genus, because here we are building the phylogenetic tree at the genus level, and therefore what we are going to do is just to see how many species with compound leaves are within that genus. So just imagine, we are talking about Fabaceae, 100%. We are talking about other genus, 70%, 50%, 0%. And we are going to relate that with the age of that genus. So we are just building our phylogeny with more than 650 genera. And are now calibrating the branch length as to estimate the age of each branch to be able to test this hypothesis. And if this hypothesis reveals to be true, then what would be the evolutionary mechanism? The evolutionary mechanism has to be put in the context of the biography of the Andes and might be related to the fact that in the lower part there has been rapid diversification of species because during the Pleistocene, because of these glacial and interglacial periods, which has acted as pans of speciation, right? Whereas in the upper part, where we find lower proportion of species with compound leaves and therefore older taxa, relatively older taxa, we might get species that have migrated either northwards from South America, from South America or southwards from North America, right? And therefore, they are older taxa with not that evolutionary trait. Okay, so that's the context of this hypothesis. But I cannot tell you anything else. We'll see in a few weeks. Okay, and then the last of the topics we are conducting research on is ecosystem functioning, and within ecosystem functioning, we are particularly interested in understanding trade-offs in carbon budgets. In tropical mountain forests and in tropical mountain forests. And tropical forests are the most important terrestrial carbon sink around the world. A lot of research has been conducted in lowland tropical evergreen forests, but not that much in tropical mountain forests. So our understanding of the role that these kind of ecosystems play as carbon reservoirs is not that much. There's this nice paper by Spracklin and Rigelato published in 2014 where they try to compile all the existing evidence, all the studies available on about tropical carbon stocks in tropical mountain forests. And two of the main conclusions of this paper were, first, that most of the studies focus in just one part of the system, which is about ground biomass. How much carbon stocks do we have in about ground biomass? But most of them disregard other part of the system, such as the soil or below ground biome. Okay. And another conclusion of this paper was that there seemed to be this negative relationship between above ground biomass, therefore above ground carbon stocks, and elevation. But when looking at the details, and you see many of the studies they use to fit this relationship, then you realize that there are many, many different relationships between AGB, above ground biomass, and elevation. Some studies report no pattern at all. Some others report a handshake relationship. Some others report even a bimodal relationship with a peak here and peak here, and so on. So there is a lot of variability. Of course, I mean, that can be understood as a generality, but when you go to a particular site, then you don't get that result, and then you get crazy trying to explain that. So there are a lot of variability. So we try to study this kind of things. So using our two study transects in southern Ecuador and Peru, we explore carbon budgets in the different forest compartments, namely above ground and below ground biomass, soil organic matter, and then also total carbon stocks. And one of the conclusions we got of this result is that effectively there is not a consistent response when you look at a particular carbon budget. There is not a consistent response between sites. So for example, in Ecuador, we got for above ground carbon stock and below ground carbon stock, we got this hat-shaped relationship, whereas in Peru, we got no relationship at all. And for soil organic carbon content, then we got in Ecuador this positive relationship, whereas in Peru, we got this hat-shaped relationship. But the interesting thing is that when considering all carbon budgets together, this total carbon stock, then you get a consistent response between sites. There is no pattern of change with elevation. So this might be pointing out to some kind of compensation mechanisms, trade-offs between the different forest compartments. So when we have a lot of carbon stock in our ground biomass, then we have low carbon stock in soil, and vice versa. So what might be explaining this pattern? So we try to relate this with climatic conditions. So we explore all the different climatic variables, and we realized that there were some of them that were consistent, changed consistently along the elevational gradients in all sites, not only these two sites, but all sites across the Andes, the tropical Andes. For example, temperature, mean annual temperature. So you have all the gradients, elevational gradients, changing quite consistently across the Andes, but some others did not. For example, precipitation seasonality. Precipitation seasonality in our two sites changed quite a lot, particularly at high elevations. So whereas in Ecuador, in the upper part of our gradient, we have basically no seasonality. So we have the same no seasonality as in the lower part. In Peru, we have some precipitation seasonality in the upper part. So we had no seasonality in the lower part, but some precipitation seasonality in the upper part. So there were differences in the two sites concerning that variable. So we use those variables to try to explain difference in carbon budgets in our study sites. And what we found is that, in general terms, there is a positive relationship of temperature with above ground and below ground carbon budgets. So the warmer the site, the more carbon you had in this forest compartment. And it was right the other way for soil organic carbon. So the warmer the place, particularly we have warmer temperatures at lower elevations, then the lower the carbon you get in the soil organic matter, in the soil compartment. Okay. But then for precipitation seasonality, we got these responses. In the warmer places, which is the red prediction line, the warmer site, you don't find much variability between sites. Most of the sites, most of the lower tropical mountain forests have low precipitation seasonality, so you don't have much variation. Even though you get a positive response, the more seasonality, the more carbon you store in the above ground and below ground forest compartment. But when you move to the upper parts of the gradient, you go to the upper tropical mountain forest to elevations up to 3,000 meters, then precipitation seasonality can vary quite a lot, and this can make an important difference. And so just imagine, we are 3,000 meters, we are in average 12 or 14 degrees centigrade, so it's rather cold, I would say. So for plants, it's not that cool. And then we have for soil microorganisms a lot of water, so we have a lot of humidity throughout the year accumulating in the water. So many of these soils are hydromorphic, which means that they accumulate more water than they can drain. So that's not good for soil microorganisms. Soil microorganisms have low temperatures and they have a lot of water, excess of water. So they cannot mineralize the organic content. They find the soil. And that results in higher concentration of carbon, a lot of organic, thick organic life in the soil. And because of that, there are no nutrients that are released into the soil, and therefore plants cannot grow that much, together with low temperatures. So we are going to get relatively low carbon content in the above ground and below ground forest compartments. But when we have some seasonality, even though this seasonality is not too much, not enough just to trigger a change from evergreen species to deciduous species, okay? Even though it's not that much, but it's enough to have a few weeks a year with less cloud in the sky, some sunny conditions, and some of the water can evaporate, and therefore those soils are not hydromorphic anymore. They don't accumulate an excess of water, and that's cool for soil microorganisms. So those soil microorganisms can mineralize organic matter in the soil, and therefore there are more nutrients available for the plants, and the plants can grow higher. So under those conditions, we are going to get higher above ground carbon content and below ground carbon content, but lower soil organic carbon content. Overall, when you put all these carbon budgets together, the result is that there is no effect of elevation on total carbon stock, and there is no effect of any of these variables on total carbon stock.
Okay.
Let's wrap up and provide a few take-home messages concerning these studies. First, environmental filtering seems to be the overriding process structuring tropical mountain forest communities, whereas competitive exclusion doesn't seem to play an important role. Even though we were measuring that with the right sampling design, but it doesn't seem to have an important role. A species turnover is exceptionally high in tropical mountain forests, but we found no decline in latitude and therefore no support to the mountain passes hypothesis proposed by Daniel Jansen in 1966 within a tropical region. We found a decrease in the proportion of species with compound leaves systematically across all the latitudinal gradient for all our elevational gradients in tropical mountain forests. But so far, we haven't found any ecological hypothesis that might explain the observed patterns. But what it seems to be true is that there is an important phylogenetic signal, and the question that remains to be answered now is, might this be phylogenetic signal be pointing out to an effect of this higher leafing intensity hypothesis? So that's what we are working on right now. And as for carbon stocks, our results reveal that there are no consistent patterns when you look just at a particular forest compartment carbon budget. There doesn't seem to be like a consistent pattern of change with elevation. But when you look at the overall carbon stock, then you see no change with elevation. And this might be suggesting that there are some kind of trade-off compensation mechanisms between different carbon budgets, and these trade-offs might be explained at least partly by changing precipitation seasonality, particularly at high elevations. And that's it. Thanks a lot for attending this seminar, and I want to acknowledge the work of so many people that have worked very hard within this and other projects funded by the Spanish Ministry. And also by the German Center for Integrative Biodiversity Research, and thanks to the OCTF again for allowing me to be here today, coming to Oxford for my second time. So thank you.